Blog Talk Radio.
I'm the dude, so that's what you call me, you know? That or his dudeness or duder or, you know, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Movie Geeks United, where the Chinaman is not the issue for Asian Americans. Tonight, your beloved movie geeks celebrate the greatest comedy of all time, The Big Lebowski, featuring a very special guest, Will Russell, co-founder of Lebowski Fest and co-author of I'm a Lebowski, You're a Lebowski. Call now and share your love of Lebowski. Talk about the actors. Talk about your favorite lines. Even talk about coitus. It don't matter to Jesus. The number to dial is 718-508-9477. So sit back, pour a smooth Caucasian, and remember, the dude abides. Here are your cinematic fanatics, Jerry, Chris, and Jamie.
Thank you for joining us for Memorial Day edition and a special edition of Movie Geeks United for The Big Lebowski. I'm here, Jerry, with Jamie and Chris. How you guys doing?
Hey. Are you ready to be fucked, man?
I've been ready since last night, but that's beside the point. Let me give the number if you want to call in, 718-508-9477. And if for some reason, if you're too shy to call us, you can send us an email at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. And you can also visit our website at myspace.com, Movie Geeks United. So, guys, what's up?
Not a whole lot. Excited about this show, man. I, you know, Big Lebowski is a favorite of all of ours, I know, and just can't wait to celebrate it, pay our little own tribute to it tonight.
It sounds like a good idea to me. I mean, it's a movie. We watched it again last night. I hadn't seen it in a while, and it's just, to say it holds up well is putting it mildly. It's genius.
It is a classic, and it gets better with each viewing. It never loses its edge.
No, it certainly
I'm excited about it. But I understand you have some exciting news. You have some friends that made a film?
Yes, I actually do have some exciting news, and I'm going to pass that along right now. In the last couple of years in the Washington, D.C. area and throughout the country, actually all over the world, there's something called the 48-Hour Film Project.
Right.
And it's where people make a short film. They give you a sentence, a phrase, a word, and about 100 different teams go spend the weekend and make about a five-minute film. And I actually know the people who won this year. Our friends Barry Gribble, who is also in charge, created the Buddy Jackson internet web sitcom that is on my page, and he won for their film the Cumbio Takedown, won first prize, the grand prize of the award, with my friend Francis Abbey, who a lot of people know. I talk about him on my blog a lot. He's a screenwriter and filmmaker. And they won the big prize, and this is just great. They also won the Best Acting, and they shared the Best Screenplay Award, and they also won the Audience Choice Award for their screening group.
Wow.
These guys did an excellent job. I mean, you know, a lot of people think D.C. is only known for corrupt politicians and Mayflower Madam types, but we really have so much more going for us, and it's been an eye-opening experience for me the last couple of years. I'd also like to throw out a pimp for Cave Girl Productions. Their movie Forge, while it didn't win, was also part of the competition. And I'd also just like to throw in here at the end of the month, these are all people who are on our Movie Geeks United site, Paul Busetti's film How Did You Lose Your Soul Sweetheart will premiere at June 28th in the Old Town Theater in Virginia. And the trailer for this film is on my webpage, and you're more than welcome to watch it. And this is all very exciting stuff for the D.C. area.
It really is. D.C. has a real kind of fervent film movement over there, don't they?
Yeah, we do. We're actually, you know, at least a couple of years ago, it was the third biggest production area in the United States behind Los Angeles and New York City. We have a lot of documentary production. We have a lot of, and obviously in the political season, lots of video and film work.
Right, right.
Yeah, are you involved in any of that filmmaking, Jerry?
I'm involved a little bit. I work on some things with my friend Francis, and I was an extra on one of the Buddy Jackson things, and that's about it, though, sadly, the last couple of years. I haven't done there's a lot I'd like to do. Hopefully next year I'll try to weasel my way into one of the 48-hour production crews.
Right.
But not this year, unfortunately. But I was very glad to see my friends win it.
Well, absolutely. Congratulations to them. That's great news.
Yeah, they sound really talented.
Oh, you would. I mean, they're incredible. Now, Jamie, you have some news.
Well, I have some news that affects all of us here on the show, and I'm sure that it's going to be a very special treat for all of our listeners too. We've been kind of dropping hints here and there about the June 3rd broadcast, which is next Sunday, which is going to be our celebration of David Lynch. And we have a show so big, so epic, that we can't fit it in 1 hour. So Blog Talk Radio has given us 2 hours for our David Lynch tribute show. And I can tell you guys to expect some big things. We've got some confirmed interviews with people that have known Lynch for most of their lives, with people that have written books on him, technical collaborators. We have some sound designers coming in that worked on the film Twin Peaks Fire Walk with me. And we have other really exciting guests that are possibly lined up that I won't get confirmation on until after Memorial Day. But it is going to be an exciting show, and I recommend that everybody keep posted to the blog announcements because you guys are not going to want to miss this. David Lynch is one of our most unique filmmakers, and we're really wanting to pay special tribute to him because he means so much to the three of us, and I know to a lot of our listeners out there as well. So mark your calendars, June 3rd, next week. It's going to be great.
No, it will definitely be great. And I just want to say, Jamie's really knocked himself out the last couple of weeks getting this organized. I mean, he's really worked hand over fist calling and emailing hundreds of people, and you've really knocked yourself out here. You've done a yeoman's job, just stellar.
Oh, Jerry, thank you, man. Thank you. It's a pleasure. As long as it comes together, it's all worth it.
You've done yourself. I actually have some sort of breaking news from Cannes, if that's the correct pronunciation of it.
I saw that. Yeah. Let's talk about that.
The Romanian film, the back alley abortion film, as it is being called, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, has won the Palme d'Or.
Hmm.
It beat out the Coen brothers, No Country for Old Men, and the Julian Schnabel film, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. And this is something. I mean, the Romanian cinema has definitely been growing in years, but this was I was kind of thought they'd go with the Coen brothers.
You know, the Coen brothers weren't represented anywhere in the awards.
Nowhere.
Gus Van Sant won a special jury prize.
Yeah, 60th anniversary jury prize for Paranoid Park. And the other jury prize was split between the Iranian film Persepolis and a Mexican film, Stella Lich, which are both very important films in their own right. But, yeah, the Coen brothers were nowhere to be seen.
Yeah. Now, Julian, what's his last name?
I think I want to say Schnabel. I know I'm pronouncing that wrong. I'll probably get crucified tomorrow morning.
I heard Schnabel.
Schnabel. We'll go with that.
Okay, the Julian guy, he's famous for, I think most people know him as the director of Basquiat.
And Before Night Falls. And he's an artist in his own. He's like Lynch, an artist in his own right.
Absolutely, but this is a French-language film, am I understanding that correctly? Wow. It's interesting because all the high profile films were American entries this year and they weren't necessarily awarded come the closing ceremonies. So that's interesting.
And the film is we were talking about last night. The jurors, most of the jurors wanted to give give the award to Sicko, but it was out of competition. But everyone wanted to give it to that for obvious reasons. That is where if Michael Moore brings a film, obviously it doesn't matter whether it's in competition or out of competition, that's what the people are going to talk about.
Right. You know, and whether or not an American film won this year, the Cannes juries are a lot like us in that they really appreciate the Coen brothers. They've given them Best Director awards, I think, 3 times, and they've really honored them in a way that American festivals and award shows usually don't. And so I think that's a pretty good segue to start into our Lebowski talk here.
Let's go. Let's do it. Let's go.
The greatest comedy of all time. First of all, are we in agreement that it is one of the best comedies of all time, if not the best?
I wouldn't say it's the best, but it's definitely up there.
I think it is the best comedy of all time.
Okay, I'll grant you that.
I literally am still laughing out loud every time I watch it. It gets better. I still notice things every time I watch it. It's just, Jamie, you know, put it really well one time and said that it's got, you know, every kind of humor that you can possibly imagine is represented in this movie, whether it's, you know, ridiculous sight gags or just really witty intellectual humor. It's all there. There's
you know, I made a comment that it's the smartest comedy ever made about stupid people. It really is. I mean, a lot of it is very basement humor, and a lot of it's very highbrow. Would you guys appreciate it like you do now the first time you watched it, though?
Yes, I watched it. You know, we watched it last night, and I watched it in its entirety last night with my family, and none of us could stop laughing. We were, you know, I was on the floor, but there's some things I noticed that I could appreciate more watching it at 36 than I could at 27, if that makes sense.
Right.
And I obviously what we were talking about earlier today is every time they ask the dude, what do you do? And, you know, it's just one of these great, that the movie takes place in Los Angeles should not be lost. It is like the city of slackers in one sense. You have the ultimate slacker. Everyone is trying to do something else in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, the dude is very content.
To do nothing.
To do nothing. And it's beautiful. But
it
gentlemen,
is.
We have, and let me just give a brief introduction to our next caller. We have a very special guest with us tonight who can speak firsthand to the cultural phenomenon that is the Big Lebowski. He is the co-founder of the Lebowski Fest, which is now in its sixth year, and he's also the co-author of the book, I'm a Lebowski, You're a Lebowski. Ladies and gentlemen, it is our pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Will Russell.
Hello, Will, are you there? Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Will, how you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, this is a real honor to have you with us tonight and for this film. I'm going to just jump out of the gate right here. Why this movie?
Man, that's a good question. That is actually one of the main questions that we address in the book that we wrote. We interviewed all the actors from the movie. We interviewed the inspirations for the characters. We interviewed fans, and that was a question that we asked everybody. And everybody, you know, kind of had different answers. You know, for me, I think it's, you know, the characters in the movie are so awesome. I just love those characters. The dialogue is so quotable, and, you know, at the end of the day, it's just a really funny movie, and it's one of those movies that stands up to repeat viewings, you know. It's like a great rock album. It's like you can watch it over and over and over again, and it just keeps somehow getting better.
You don't even have to watch it. You can just listen to it.
Yeah.
Have it on in the background. I mean, whenever I'm feeling a little bummed out, I just put it in, you know, just maybe watch 20 minutes of it or something, and I'm laughing out loud before I know it.
Right.
Did you get a sense when you were conducting these interviews for the book that the actors had any realization that they were working on something so special, or were they as surprised as everyone that it became this kind of phenomenon that it has?
Everybody was really pretty surprised. I mean, Jeff Bridges, for example, he was, he thought the movie was awesome. Like, when he did it, he was really kind of bummed out that it didn't do well, you know, in its initial release. He was like, I don't understand why people aren't into this. So he was really pleased when he saw kind of the whole cult following, you know, developing behind it. But, you know, most of the people, they're, you know, we'd be interviewing, you know, like Julianne Moore or something, and we'd have all these nerdy questions for her, and she would just be like, you know, we did this like 8 or 9 years ago. She's like, I'm having trouble remembering this part. And we're just like, you don't understand. To the actors, I think it was, you know, they were just making a movie. You know, they had a job. They got hired to do a movie. But to us, you know, to the fans, it means something altogether different.
Yeah, it surprises me how many stars, how many high-profile actors are actually in that film.
Yeah.
You kind of forget, and then you revisit it, and you see Philip Seymour Hoffman, and
mm-hmm.
Julianne Moore. And
Ben Gazzara.
Yep.
Oh, Tara Reid.
Yes. Will, I have to ask you a very important question, though.
Uh-huh.
Were you hooked right away?
No, not really, actually. The first time I saw it in the theaters, and I didn't dislike it, but I was kind of, like, indifferent to it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, you know, that was kind of cool, but I don't know. You know, it didn't really do a lot for me. And then I ended up catching it on video again, and then it was the third time that I saw it. And this has been generally true for most people I talk to, that it takes three times until all of a sudden you're like, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Right, right.
Like the 87th time I saw
man.
It
That's
was my favorite.
You know, it's really funny. When I saw it the first time, I saw it on a very, it was actually, I was talking with Jamie earlier, it was a very busy film-going weekend.
Yeah.
And there were just parts that really, I couldn't stop laughing while watching this film. I saw it with a couple of friends, and we saw it on a Saturday after it came out. John Goodman's always been a very funny, talented actor, but he seems to let loose in this film like never before and never after, I may add. And John Turturro, you know, the Coen brothers always get a great performance out of him. And what I realized, I was watching it again last night, he's not in the film that much, Turturro.
Oh, God, no.
But when he is, it's priceless.
Yeah, yeah. He really, it gets burned into your memory. So when you think back on the Big Lebowski, you think about the Jesus.
Oh, you can't help but think about the Jesus.
But in terms of actual screen time, you're right. I mean, he doesn't have probably more than 6 or 7 minutes. We talked to him about that role, and it was pretty cool to learn that a lot of the things that the Jesus did were Turturro's idea. Like the Coke nail when he has the purple fingernail.
Right.
And licking the ball. Those were Turturro's ideas. And it was funny. He said that the dance that he does and kind of his whole persona was based on Muhammad Ali.
Oh, I don't know what to say about that exactly.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, Muhammad Ali is from where I'm from, Louisville, Kentucky. And, you know, if you watch it with that in mind, you'll see, like, when Muhammad Ali is, like, taunting people and yelling at people and, like, getting in people's faces, and he does that little dance.
Right.
There is some similarities there. But Turturro said when he first saw, like, the dailies or whatever of him in that jumpsuit doing this thing, he was like, this is either going to ruin my career or it's going to make me famous.
we might have touched on this before, but we probably did. When did you kind of realize that this cultural phenomenon was happening? And it also, just for me, refresh me, when did this really become, it is this cult film, the ultimate cult film, if you will, of the 21st century?
Yeah. Well, I mean, me and my buddy Scott, who started the Lebowski Fest, we used to, like, sell T-shirts together. And we, back in 2002, we were just vending this, like, tattoo convention. We were really bored. And we would quote lines from the Big Lebowski to entertain ourselves. And it occurred to us that we should have a Big Lebowski party at a bowling alley. And, you know, so we put one on in October of 2002, and we thought that maybe, like, 20 of our friends would show up. And we ended up having like 150 people come out. People traveled from all over, and it just kind of spread. And we were just kind of shocked to learn that there were so many other people like us that were kind of obsessed with the movie. And so we put up the website, LebowskiFest.com. And the next thing we knew, like Spin Magazine had picked it up. It was like a little blurb in their events guide. And, you know, we went from 150 people to like 1,200 people.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So, I mean, we had no idea, you know. Our first, while we were at this particular tattoo convention, we were quoting lines, and this other booth next to us kind of joined in, these guys from another state, and we kind of had our first taste of, like, bonding, you know, over the movie.
Right.
So that was where we first started to realize that we weren't the only ones, you know.
Yeah, do you screen the film during Lebowski Fest? Is that the culmination of the weekend? How does the weekend work?
It's basically a two-night thing. The first night we usually have bands play, and then we screen the movie after the bands play. And then the next day we'll have some bands, and then we have the main event inside of a bowling alley. And it's just madness. We pack it full of people in costumes like Nihilists and Valkyrie, severed toes and giant Creedence cassette tapes. And
Caucasian.
Everybody drinks White Russians and bowls, and we have, like, costume contests and trivia contests and
That's
bowling.
Quite a combination, White Russians and bowling.
Let me tell you.
Do you have any, have there been any fond memories for you for the festival so far?
Yeah, I mean, they're all just so amazing because it's just like being around a bunch of people like me. And, I mean, I think the standout moment was the Lebowski Fest we did in Los Angeles. Jeff Bridges showed up.
Oh.
And, like, he wore his jellies that he wears in the movie. A lot of that stuff he wears in the movies belongs to him. So he wore his jelly sandals, and we were sitting, like, backstage after he had actually played that night. He plays guitar and stuff. And I asked him about his jellies, and he was like, "What size shoe do you wear?" I was like, 11, and he was like, "Here." And he took off one of his jellies, and he threw it over, and he's like, "Try it on." I was like, "Oh, my God." So I took off my shoe, and I went to put my foot in, and he stopped me, and he's like, "No, man, I want you to take your sock off. I want you to get the full experience." So I was like, "Okay." So I slipped my foot in there. It was a little wet. Well, but I could feel the spirit of the dude rush up into my leg, and I was, like, instantly relaxed. I was just like, oh, yeah.
I think Big Lebowski works so well just based on Bridges' performance. If you think about him, he's always regarded as one of our most underrated actors.
Oh, yeah.
You think about the dude, and then you see what he did directly after the dude. He played the president in that film, The Contender.
Yeah, that's right.
Incredible range.
Well, I think it's incredible. I mean, I think it's great. Only in America can you be the ultimate slacker and then become the leader of the free world.
Well, some would argue that the leader of our free world right now is the ultimate slacker.
And let me tell you this, and I will say this right now, and I will promise I will not get political anymore. That is an insult to slackers everywhere. Jesus Christ.
You talked a little bit about some of the inspirations for the characters. Obviously, there's Jeff Dowd, who was the inspiration for the dude. And then there's the one that a lot of people don't know about. I'm sure I know you do, John Milius.
Yeah,
I just learned about that today.
Yeah,
really,
he's quite a character, man. He wrote Apocalypse Now. He wrote and directed Conan the Barbarian, Red Dawn. You may remember with Patrick Swayze.
Right.
Yeah.
But he's kind of like this, he's like a super conservative Hollywood.
Yes, he is.
And what's funny is that shit doesn't fly well in Hollywood. You know, Hollywood's a very liberal place. So Milius,
yes, it is.
Against the grain, as he put it, he's not housebroken. But, you know, he apparently, I heard a story that he has a big, like, mushroom cloud mural in his house. And on his 40th birthday, he cut his birthday cake with a, sword used from Conan the Barbarian, and he's just the funny thing about him being Walter being based on him is that he's totally cool with that. Like he's like yeah, you know, I take it as a compliment.
He would like Walter. I think the two of them would get along.
Well, Walter and he would get along splendidly. I mean,
he said his favorite part of the movie is when Walter bites the ear off the nihilist at the end and spits it in the air. He said it makes him want to stand up and cheer.
Well, I'm glad that Mr. Milius can get that satisfaction. I actually, you know, I'm not a conservative. I'm actually the opposite on political views, but I do appreciate the early work of John Milius.
Yeah.
But I will say this, though. Red Dawn is got to be the greatest science fiction film ever made. That I mean, talk about unrealistic. but I think
Jerry did a J before he watched Red Dawn, maybe.
No, I mean, it's just, at the time, I remember when that movie came out, and it was just like, people were just like, you've got to be kidding me. He thinks that the Nicaraguans and the Cubans can do a full-scale invasion of Middle America?
Yeah, but doesn't that sound like the kind of scheme that Walter would cook up?
Exactly.
What I want to know, and I'm going to throw this out here, this isn't on the plan, but do you think... And it would be a bad idea, but what would a sequel to The Big Lebowski, if it took place today, where would these characters be?
That's a good question.
Especially,
man.
Walter. I mean, he'd probably be,
you know,
gung-ho Bush, you know.
Like if it was in modern day, like 2007?
Yeah. Or even if you wanted to do it right at the beginning of the current war, like in 2003.
Yeah. I don't know, man.
Has there been any feelers out there to any of the actors want a sequel to it?
Well, John Goodman specifically said that making The Big Lebowski was like the highlight of his career, and that Walter is his favorite character that he's ever done, and that he loves when people come up to him and quote The Big Lebowski.
He didn't say King Ralph?
No. He said if it would have been Fred Flintstone, he would have stuck a 9mm in his mouth. Walter's the one that stuck. But yeah, he said I would love nothing more than to get together with those guys and do a sequel. He said, but it would mess everything up. He said, you know, you can't do it without Donnie.
No, that's true. That's very true. And last night watching it, I was heartbroken when Donnie leaves us. I was very heartbroken during that scene. I always am, but dumb. All right, can you, for the Lebowski, the 6th annual Lebowski Fest that's coming up in Louisville on July 20th, 21st this year, what can attendees expect?
What's that?
What can the attendees expect for this year's Lebowski Fest?
Friday night, the first night, we're going to have a couple bands play Dr. Dog and Vietnam. Have you ever heard of Vietnam? They're going to play, and then we're going to screen the movie, and this is going to be outdoors in a big field next to the bowling alley. And then the next day is what we call the garden party, where we have a bunch of bands play, like the legendary Shack Shakers, and then like this 400-pound rapper named Kentucky Prophet going to perform. And we have like Lebowski-themed games, like the ringer toss, where we throw a bag of dirty undies towards a target, and the marmot fling, and the Sheriff of Malibu coffee mug toss. Lots of tosses going on there. And then that Saturday night is the main event, the bowling event, where your ticket gets you unlimited bowling and shoe rental, and then all the costume contests and trivia contests and a whole lot of what have you.
Wow, it sounds like a really good time. Hell, I'll have to come up with that.
Everybody enjoys it, and the people that come are good people. You know, it's kind of people that appreciate Coen Brothers' sense of humor, but still like to party and have a good time.
I was going to ask you about that. Like any movie and any phenomenon that has a lot of followers, you know, whether it's the Rocky Horror Picture Show or something, or Monty Python. Sometimes there's people that are just really like so into it that it's scary, and that they can make you feel a little uncomfortable. Are there any people like that with The Big Lebowski, or are they all, you know, do they all like just kind of dutified kind of attitude?
Yeah, I mean, everybody's pretty laid back, and, you know, you're kind of asking the wrong person because I am one of them, you know. I am.
Right.
That's good. I like you, so I look forward to hanging out with you. So.
Yeah, it's a fun crowd. I mean, it's really diverse, man. You know, there's a lot of, like, college kids, but there's also, like, some middle-aged, like, there's Vietnam vets that come out that are into, like, the Walter character. There's lawyers and layabouts and bums and all kinds of people.
Well, I want to ask you something before we get to how our listeners can purchase tickets to the Lebowski Fest and purchase your book as well. Do you have a favorite moment or a favorite line from the film?
My favorite lines are kind of always changing, but I think right now my favorite is the enjoying my coffee scene, where Walter gets really mad in the family restaurant, and that lady asks him to keep his voice down. He's like, "I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee." And like, he's so clearly not enjoying it, but he's just determined not to be pushed around.
Right.
Because he was a veteran. Yeah,
For me, I find myself laughing hysterically at a part that kind of whizzes by other people. It's when the landlord knocks on his door and says something to the effect of, "Dude, the rent's due.
Tomorrow's already the 10th.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's like, "Far out."
Far out, man.
He doesn't get it at first. So for some reason, that just slays me every time.
This guy would just knock on the door to tell him that. Tomorrow's already the 10th.
It's all so good. I mean, for me, it's just like 2 hours of bliss. I'm just like, you know, I just enjoy every minute of it.
Yeah. So tell us about how people can purchase these the tickets to Lebowski.
But also tell us about the book also. I'm a Lebowski, you're a Lebowski.
It's a fan book, you know, that we put together. And, you know, we did a bunch of stuff. We interviewed all the actors from the film about the movie. We interviewed the inspirations like Jeff Dowd, John Milius, and a few other guys. We even found the real Little Larry. That whole homework in a baggie scene actually happened.
Wow.
And we interviewed both the guys and we found Little Larry, who until we called him that day, had no idea that he had influenced the scene in The Big Lebowski. Totally blew this kid's mind. He had seen the movie, but it didn't occur to him that that was what happened to him when he was 12. So that was one of the crowning achievements of the book, was tracking him down and interviewing him. We talked to a bunch of fans, Patton Oswalt, Tony Hawk, the Powerpuff Girls creator, Craig McCracken, is a big fan. You see a lot of Lebowski references in his cartoons.
Right.
Bunch of other people. And then we've got a whole bunch of, like, trivia, and then we've got, like, this little time code guide where you can watch the movie, and it'll say, like, at 3 minutes and 42 seconds, it'll have a little bit of trivia. You know, like, that's Jeff Dowd in the background, or there's a kind of a locations guide. There's a bunch of goofy stuff, dude libs, and how to dutify your office space. And oh, there's a little Larry flip book, like, where you can flip through, and Larry will just stonewall you the whole time.
And our listeners can purchase this book through Amazon?
Yeah, you can get it a bunch of places, but if you go to LebowskiFest.com, there's a page that kind of talks about the book and a link to Amazon. Same with the tickets for the events. They can purchase them through our website. There's links through the website. LebowskiFest.com has got a bunch of cool stuff, a bunch of pictures from the fests and what have you.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, that's wonderful. We really appreciate you calling in today on a Memorial Day weekend and sharing this with us, because this is definitely one of those films. I guess I'd like to close. Do you think this film has, in the late 70s and late 80s, we had a bunch of great comedies like Caddyshack and Animal House and Stripes. Do
right.
you think this film has maybe surpassed those in its cult-like status?
Yeah, I don't really know. I think that in a lot of ways this one is smarter than those.
Oh yes, without a doubt.
Yeah, so I think that gives it a little more, I don't know, just a little more for people to sink their teeth into. You know, like last year we had an academic symposium, people talked about philosophies and all kinds of different stuff, whereas those are really funny movies, but then at the end of the day they're just kind of funny movies. No.
That's true. At the time, because they featured, like, Harold Ramis was the writer behind us, they are considered, by today's standards, actually very subversive, but no, I mean, The Big Lebowski, intellectually, is light years ahead of them.
Yeah, and it's got political stuff going on, too. It's got religious stuff going on, you know. There's all kinds of angles to look at The Big Lebowski.
Okay, well, yeah. A lot of ins and outs, a lot of what have you.
A lot of what have you.
Well, a lot of interested parties.
Will, thank you so much for calling in
and
sharing this information with us. We really appreciate it. It was a pleasure to finally talk to you.
All right, dudes. Take her easy.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. What a great guest.
Yes. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I could feel that he was a kindred spirit. You know, I mean, even if we weren't talking about Lebowski, I feel like I could, you know, chill with this guy, you know. Maybe do a J and some bowling.
Yeah, I sent him the confirmation email today to remind him to what time to call in and everything, and the whole lineup of stuff we'd be talking to him about. And he wrote back and he said, "I'll be there, man.
I'll be there, man."
He was great, dude. He was awesome. I mean, he
far out, man. Far fucking out.
You know, why does the Lebowski work? Why do you guys think it works ultimately?
The dude. I think it's the dude. Everyone has been, you know, at some point, like today. It's Memorial Day weekend. A lot of people have the day off tomorrow, you know, today, on the weekends. You just kind of want to chill out. You don't want to do anything. You get in one of those moods, or maybe you want to be like the dude, you know. You just want to, like, chill. But the dude is like that all the time. And everyone can identify with that. Everyone's like, yeah, you know, just all the dude wants is his rug back, you know? Like,
it is. It's like this is the Robert Benton film, The Late Show, almost, in one sense. But, basically, this is about someone who has, some guy has, you know, deliberately, you know, soils his rug.
Right.
And it's all about, and the rug is like the MacGuffin at the end, you know, halfway through the movie. No one cares about the rug anymore. But, you know, it's a horrible act, you know, and I've seen my share of soiled rugs. But, you know, it's a horrible thing to have your rug that happened to it.
I think personally, for the greatest joy that I get from watching the movie is the interaction between the three of them, the dude, Walter, and Donnie.
They are iconic. They really are.
It just seems so perfectly timed. They're back and forth. It's just so effortless, and I've never seen chemistry like that on screen between actors and their characters going at it with each other. It's
not between three, maybe between two, but you're right. Between three people, it's like this. It's like something that you don't see very often. That strong.
It's just this perfect, priceless thing, and that's why I don't think they should touch it with a sequel. I mean,
no, I agree. I just brought that up because I was kind of, you know how, you know, this horrible trend that started, I guess, a couple of fan fiction, you know, oh, let's find out what Harry Potter is doing when he's 55 in a retirement home or something. You know, I just thought in that way it would be kind of curious, although I would never want to see it because having, whenever you make a sequel so long after the original film, it sucks.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you guys, though, because I always thought it was the kind of movie that would be. You know, first of all, it's not like it's the Coen brothers directed it, but it was written by somebody else. They wrote it. And they wrote it with, you know, this sort of, I mean, it is kind of loosely based around like a Dashiell Hammett kind of detective story. And that's what it's intended to be. There's no reason,
that's
I don't think,
genius.
Why.
That was genius. That you just came up with that? That's a genius. Dude, that we can quote that. I mean,
I didn't come up with it. They've said that themselves. That's what they, you know, they were kind of wanting to do like a detective story, and that's what the movie is. And that's why the brother Seamus at the end of the movie sort of identifies with him as a fellow private detective, even though he doesn't intend to be. That's what the dude is. I think they could easily make, you know, I always thought Son of Dude would be a good title for the second movie, since he obviously is having a child, you know.
That's cool. Hey, guys, we have a caller from the 571 area code. Let's patch him through. Hey, welcome to Movie Geeks United.
Please leave that motherfucking movie alone and don't make another sequel.
Oh, come on.
Hey, who do we have here?
Oh, there's no reason to make another sequel. It's perfect the way it is. I'm tired of everything being bastardized and coming in threes. This is Mark, by the way.
Reason. Hey, Mark,
there's no reason. There's no fucking reason why they go out.
Simon is not the issue here. And I will say that my favorite part of that movie, among many, is when they're burying Donnie at sea, and Walter's releasing the ashes into the Pacific Ocean. They start blowing all over the dude's face, and he's taking a ball sack full of Donnie in his face.
Yeah,
Chris,
out of a Folgers can, though.
Yes,
right?
It is
because we're breathing doesn't make us snap.
But it is our most reasonably priced receptacle. I fucking love that movie. Any attempt to try to ruin it by going back, and the only reason that anyone would go back and try to make another sequel is because of money. It's already.
Yeah, but here's a case where you don't. All right, and it's probably why there would never be a sequel, because the first one made no money. In the theater, I don't really see there being. I don't see. I mean, and even the company it was distributed, PolyGram Entertainment, is out of business now. So I don't really see there being a sequel because I
think the dignified thing to do, which they're doing right now, is to come together annually, drink your Caucasians, you know, talk about bowling, whatnot, and listen to really, really bad Euro techno crap, and you know, be done with it.
It's one of those things. It's like, I don't know if it would work. I don't know if it could work. But I think that there is a possibility that it could work. And, I, you know, sometimes they made the two Jakes. Does that ruin Chinatown for anybody?
No, you're talking to someone who doesn't mind the two Jakes. Doesn't love it, but doesn't hate it, though.
Well, that's what I'm saying. This could be very much the same thing. And the Coen brothers have never made a sequel.
Do you think that the dude should be like Abbott and Costello, like the dude meets Frankenstein?
No!
Or...
No!
Nobody's saying that.
You're ugly fucking jerk on face off my movie. Thanks for taking my call.
Hey, anytime.
Thanks for calling.
That's great. Yeah. Okay, so we have one adamant voice that no sequel. Okay, I'm never going to open up my mouth ever again about sequels.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to it if all the original creators were back.
Oh, that's what I mean. Under no circumstances would I be interested. Well, I would go see it no matter who was in it, but, you know, I don't think
I'd fly down to Florida to see it with you.
Oh, man, we'd fly up there. You know, you'd have to have Jeff Bridges. You'd have to have Walter. You'd have to have the Coen brothers. You know, you got to have everybody, literally everyone. You could bring new characters back, but it wouldn't work without the key people.
It absolutely would not work without Flea. I think that's the
well, you know, right there. I mean, I can't argue with that.
Without Flea and Tara Reid, I mean, you can't.
Tara Reid, you know, she's the Lana Turner of the 21st century. I did not say that.
but yeah, and I've heard interviews with Jeff Bridges where he has said, "This is the favorite character I've ever played." You know, he's so, I mean, he's very in love with that character.
I would not I'm telling you, I would not count it out. It would not surprise me at all. Every filmmaker gets curious at some point about making a sequel, you know, I think. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if one day they did that, the Coen brothers.
Mm.
And I think if anybody could, if they set out to make a sequel, I don't think there's a lot of filmmakers out there that I would have faith in to, you know, to take care of, you know, my baby, which is how I feel about the Big Lebowski. But I feel comfortable that the Coen brothers could make it, could do it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as long as they're involved, it wouldn't be, you know, if, like, Joel Schumacher came along, then I'd be really, really frightened.
Don't get me started on Joel Schumacher.
We're not going to, well, that's another show. That's another show. But if we could exit the Big Lebowski, this weekend, we saw, at least Chris and I saw, the third Pirates of the Caribbean film. Any thoughts, Chris, that you want to share with the movie-going public?
Well, my thoughts are, you know, I thought the first one was cute enough. You know, it was nice to see Johnny Depp in a big performance in a big movie, you know, getting his due finally. I thought the nuance of that performance had basically worn off by the second movie, and it was exposed for, you know, what it was. And by this third movie, luckily, they bring Jeffrey Rush back, but unfortunately, you only get a chance to let that performance just gets a chance to get old. And at this point, the Johnny Depp performance is not working at all anymore. The movie's a mess. It makes, I defy anyone that says that they followed the first hour and a half of the movie.
I couldn't follow the first hour. I don't. The problem is when I exit these movies, the film exits with me.
Right.
I have no retention of these films, sadly. I know there's a lot of people who love them, and I like the last hour of this film. I thought it was very exciting, actually, but it takes so long to get there that the movie is a chore to sit through. I think the first 90 minutes, and no movie the first 90 minutes like that should be a chore to sit through.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's why
I haven't been to see it, exactly, because I can already tell the movie's going to give me a headache. And I don't want to pay that amount of money just to be bludgeoned to death with, you know, my brain swelling out of my cranium, you know.
Yeah. And the movie has very little going for it. The series of movie has very little going for it, other than the fact that the whole world seems to love them.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, thematically, the first, while I do think that the Johnny Depp performance for me has gotten old, the first 30 minutes or so, there is no Johnny Depp, and you feel it.
You
feel
it in the way,
the absence of Johnny Depp in that first 30 minutes.
Oh,
it's time.
You can hear a pin drop.
Yeah.
And I think the thing is, and you know, this is a, you know, Bruckheimer just gets richer and richer each year. But I'd love to see if Don Simpson was alive, if these films would be made quite the way they are. I mean,
well, you know,
I think they might
know.
Be.
You might be. I just thought maybe there'd be a lot. They'd be a lot more raunchier.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. It did sort of seem like as soon as Don Simpson passed, it was like, you know, Con Air and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It got stupider and stupider. And this is more of the same. I mean, it's just there's nothing there. There's nothing there at all, unfortunately. It's a great cast, too. That's one of the things that struck me, too, while I was watching it. There's a lot of great actors, from Johnny Depp to Jeffrey Rush to
Stellan Skarsgård.
Dylan Starsgard to Bill Nighy, you know, and then there's other people who just don't work for me, you know, like Keira Knightley. I just don't understand the appeal yet, other than she's very attractive.
Well,
Orlando Bloom, who I thought Peter Travers hit it on the head when he described Orlando Bloom as aggressively bland.
And
yeah.
In the first two films, I would say you're right. I actually felt in this film the two of them finally worked, and it's not to the last hour, but I felt they really. Out of, I guess, what is it, 9 hours of celluloid,
Yeah.
They finally, in the last hour, it's like, hey, this actually works, but it's sadly, it's been never really, you know, it doesn't really work until that point. I didn't mind them, but yeah, it takes a while. And you know what? Chow Yun Fat is just once again wasted.
Yeah.
It is
a shame, too.
Yeah.
And well, the few scenes that he has, you can see that he's, you know, he's got a lot of charisma and he's exciting to see on screen, but he's just wasted in this movie.
Yeah, he's the closest thing. I mean, a lot of the actors, a lot of the Asian actors over the last 20 years, I definitely feel personify the old Hollywood greatness, and I do think Chow Yun-Fat definitely has kind of like always been like a mix of Robert Mitchum and Cary Grant, and sadly in the American films that he's been given, he just doesn't, there's no way for him to, for this to come out. And
it doesn't
comes
translate.
Out.
No. Unfortunately.
So it's a waste.
You know, I just got an idea. You guys mentioned Don Simpson. Isn't that a bio movie just dying to be made of Don Simpson?
Yes. For a variety of reasons.
I would cast Ron Silver. You know, what an explosive life. A life that was, if nothing else, it was about excess. So never doubt for a second that these pirate movies would take a different direction if Don Simpson were still alive.
I'm sure they would.
Yeah, he's all about the excess, man.
Yes, he is. His biography about him, High Concept, that came out after his death, is that's all it's about is his excess.
Yeah, that's all he was about. I mean, you know, somebody that passes away on the toilet reading an Oliver Stone biography, that tells you everything you need to know. Anyway, I didn't mean to kill the conversation.
No, you didn't kill the conversation. I was going to bring it up if you didn't. I want to know what's in that book. I want to know what
proceed.
The revelation was. I read it, but what was it that was on that book that he croaked on the toilet?
Probably a dime bag of cocaine. I don't know what was in the book.
Yeah, that was his infamous last release on that toilet.
Yeah.
that...
There you have it, folks. One of the greatest lines ever in the history of Movie Geeks United.
The thing about the Pirates movies is, though, you know, people are comparing them to, you know, like the Lord of the Rings movies or the Harry Potter movies. Those movies were written by one person. You know, the Lord of the Rings movies, it's three stories. They were meant to be three stories. One writer planned them out as three stories. What happened with Pirates is not the same thing.
No,
one movie
it's many
out,
writers, many cooks, you know, in the kitchen.
One movie came out, hit it big, and then they said, okay, how can we build an epic story on top of that? Well, that first movie was not designed to handle, it's not structured to handle an epic story that they built on top of it with part two and part three, so it collapses. The whole thing falls like a Jenga tower. They need to follow suit, you know, they need to look at the Bond movies. That's how you can make a successful and, you know, and respectable Pirates franchise. Just take everyone, make it a new adventure. You don't need this epic story following through with every movie that has a sequel. Make it a new adventure.
Now, you have a good point there. You have a good point because what happens is, and I mean, I know I'm in the minority here as far as fans of the film go, it's just there's so much, they're so convoluted. You're just like, wait, he's with her? You know, and all this stuff, and you're like, wait, what is this? You know, what curse? You know, all this, you're just like, my God, this makes Lord of the Rings look simple.
Right,
but
there's all these allegiances and trails, and it's so difficult to follow.
I think when they make their sequel to Big Lebowski, they need to follow the James Bond model as well.
Well, that's exactly what I mean. You know, take a whole new story. That's how the Lebowski thing could work. You know,
instead of like a Bond girl, you can have a dude girl. It'll be good.
Well, that's an interesting point.
Exactly.
That's fucking interesting, man. That's fucking interesting.
That is. That's very fucking interesting. Well, as we're waiting for legendary film critic Tony DeFrancisco to call in with his flick pick, I figured why don't we go ahead and give our flick picks while we're waiting.
Sounds great.
Let's do that.
Jamie or Chris, would you like to start?
I'll go ahead.
Have you the flick pick yet, Chris?
Yeah. Have I? Yeah, I've got a flick pick. We had a caller, friend of mine named Ty, call in last week and diss my boy Woody Allen, who I am just, you know, I'm in love with his entire catalog, frankly. Even the ones that don't work, I still love them. But Ty said he didn't see a lot, he hasn't seen a lot of the better Woody Allen movies, so I thought I would recommend what I think is among, you know, the top three, and it's from 1989. It's Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Thank you.
And it represents exactly what Woody Allen, in top form, is capable of. And it also is one of his best performances on film, even though he plays a supporting role. And Martin Landau is the main character, and he is dynamite. You know, a lot of people of my generation, you know, film geeks, only know him really in as Bela Lugosi in Ed Wood. That's the
Or Space 1999.
I'm sorry?
Or Space 1999. Remember that series?
Oh, yeah. No, I don't, actually. But
okay, great. I just really... Well, you know, that movie has one of the greatest lines of all time in it. Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Oh, let me guess which line you're talking about. The last time I was inside a woman was when I went to visit the Statue of Liberty.
Yes, and on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we have with us probably the most... A man who watches more movies than Quentin Tarantino, our very own Tony DeFrancisco.
Yes,
Tony, are you there?
Yep, I'm right here.
Oh, my God. I mean, this is a day that is going to be long remembered. Tony DeFrancisco is calling in. Tony, you have the floor.
All right. My film pick for, well, I guess, for right now is a movie called Film Geek.
Hmm.
Yep. It was independently made from, I think it was Portland, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. It's about this guy named Scotty Pelk. He's a film geek, kind of like us four.
Yeah, there's no doubt there.
And he gets fired from his job because, I guess, well, he's like us. He'll recommend movies that people don't want to see. Like... Right now, if there was someone going to rent a movie like Epic Movie, God bless their souls.
Oh, yeah.
He'll recommend some other movie, like The Fountain, that they had no interest in.
That's a very good point, and he would definitely hate Happy Feet, that's for sure.
Yep. And while on the subway one day, he meets this girl named, I can't remember what it was, and see it for like about 2 weeks now, and you know he falls for her, and but she has a boyfriend, and they, you know, they talk to each other, they keep in touch.
No.
So
this movie out on DVD?
Yes.
I actually got it from Netflix last year. It really is a real charming movie, and I guarantee every film geek in the world owes it to themselves to watch this movie.
Yes, it's a great movie. It is a wonderful movie.
It's so sad that I see so much of myself.
I think we all did. I mean, I know I did. I was kind of cringing during this movie, okay? I was cringing while watching. I watched it, I guess, the end of last summer, and, yeah, I saw too much of myself in it.
Me too. And Scotty, while he has the video store withdrawal, he's trying to apply to all these other video stores in the Portland and Oregon area, and he can't seem to find the one job. And whenever he walks by his old store, he feels lonely.
You're not riding a horse, are you?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're calling from your cell phone, right?
Yeah.
Are you fighting other children with your hockey stick?
Yeah. I actually have a game in about an hour. So.
Okay, good luck, man. Good luck on that.
Thanks.
We're rooting for you. I'm rooting on you to start fights, too. But your mom did not hear that from me.
I only got thrown out of one game.
Oh, my God.
Well, that pick sounds like it's perfect for our show.
That's
perfect.
Like
the kind of
movie
that all of our listeners would love.
Yeah. Tony, will you stay on for the rest of the show?
Yeah.
Okay. Jamie, your pick.
This is actually something I was going to pick a couple of weeks ago because we were talking about the big Spider-Man craze and how talented Sam Raimi is as a director. One of the movies on his resume that people don't know a lot about is the movie called A Simple Plan.
Great movie.
Yeah, it's Billy Bob Thornton, Bill Paxton, Bridget Fonda, I believe. It's a great kind of character movie, something that people that only know Raimi for Spider-Man might not really expect from him, or even The Evil Dead. It's these guys find a crashed plane in the woods filled with drug money, and it raises kind of a moral quandary in all of their lives, and they're true, like, dark natures come out, you know, that greed corrupts you, absolutely. It's a very, very good genre movie. And I would say that as a double feature, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to pick two this week because it's similar.
You dirty dog.
I'm sorry. I got to get this in. Sam Raimi also directed a film called The Gift.
You picked two good ones here.
Which is an absolutely phenomenal movie. Also a little bit of a quirky little character-driven genre film. Cate Blanchett, Keanu Reeves, you'd go crazy over this cast. It's about a clairvoyant that kind of witnesses a murder. It's very quirky and kooky, and I'd recommend
great cast in that movie.
Yeah, very good cast.
Amazing, and he's very good with character. And I think that any success that Spider-Man has had has been based on that strength that he has. He really follows through on character very well.
No, hopefully he'll go back to it.
Those are both very good picks. Yeah, he'll go back. Well, my pick, and I guess this is where we start losing listeners or subscribers, I'm going to go to a film that's very personal for me, or at least the story is, a movie from 1984, and my brothers are going to groan when they hear this. You're going to hear laughing through the New York and Maryland area. Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan of the Apes.
Oh,
and I'm
going to... You don't have to go to the New York or Maryland area to hear groaning.
Okay, yeah, I knew I'd get it from you, but this is a last-minute pick. I picked this at 5:25, and I'm holding the DVD. Okay, I'm holding the DVD, folks. Yes,
oh, you're the one that bought that?
Yes, I'm the one that bought that. Yes, I bought it at Target like 5 years ago or whatever. But I was just thinking about this movie. It's one of the few movies that I like Christopher Lambert in, and it's also, I think, one of the best representations of the Tarzan movies, probably outside the Johnny Weissmuller films. And I just always, it works, but it's the best thing about this film is it's Ralph Richardson's last performance, and he's wonderful in it. He's just fantastic. Ian Holm is great in it, but it works on a lot of levels. But I just really thought of this film because one of my great quotes of my dad is, when we were growing up and still is, just because you smell like ape shit doesn't mean you're Tarzan. And, you know, there you go. That's why I picked this. Just
hey,
for that quote alone.
Wasn't John Milius involved in that movie?
No, John Milius was not. Actually, you were probably thinking of Robert Towne, who used a pseudonym for the script because he wasn't happy with it. But
they say that that movie had one of the best unproduced scripts in history. Yeah, before they massacred it for the final cut.
See, I don't think it's massacred. Someone who's familiar with the Tarzan myth and the story, you're not going to, unless the Del Toro, the Guillermo Del Toro version that he's going to make in a couple years really goes back to the Edgar Rice Burroughs roots, this is, for me, the definitive version of the film.
Yeah. I don't see that way, but okay.
yeah, I figured. I knew I was going out on a limb, you know?
If you want a fist fight, you know, I'm right here, dude.
I'm ready.
I'll take the animated Disney movie.
Oh, the animated Disney is shameful.
The Phil Collins music alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, who better to give voice to Tarzan than the music of Phil Collins?
Yeah, that movie's insulting. I'm sorry.
All right, well, that was an interesting pick.
Yeah, I can see. I'm going to stick to my guns next time and pick something even more out there.
All right, is Tony still on the line?
Hey, Tony, are you still there?
Right here.
He's being asphyxiated by a pillow. I don't know what's going on with his cell phone.
I don't know, what is going on? I mean, you really sound like you're in, like, Singapore.
Now I'm all walking around trying to get ready.
Yeah, you got the big hockey game. All right, well,
yeah.
Tony, thank you so much for calling in. It is a real pleasure to hear your voice.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime.
When we can hear your voice.
Yeah, when we can hear your voice.
Thank you, Tony, very much.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure. I've been waiting for you. And, okay, we are at the end of our show. I want to thank Chris and Jamie, my faithful co-hosts, for guiding me through this. I want to thank Will Russell for calling in. I want to thank Tony again. And I want to thank all of you for listening to us on your Memorial Day holiday weekend. And next week is the big week. We have the David Lynch extravaganza.
That's right.
And, you know, thank you very much. Good night, everybody.
Thank you, Jerry.
Good night.